University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce. I'm here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. We do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. Very tight show today. We've got two very full hours what you'll hear is from Poets at Art Fest 10. It was our 10th annual three-day outdoor festival held this past July 1st weekend, and now we're about halfway through sharing readings from it. In the first hour, you'll hear from the Sunday mid-afternoon sessions readings back-to-back by Jen Frankel, Honey Novick, Ron Chase, and Calista Markotic. I should mention this festival is part of the Art Fest Kingston Artist Festival each year. In the second hour, you're going to hear readings in that same period by Susan McMaster, Doris Fisher, and Susan J. Atkinson. Just my usual start of the hour announcement. Occasionally some poetry, spoken word, or music played on this show may contain strong language, but it's all played in its entirety with content unedited to honor the creative integrity of both the author and the piece. So tell you what, let's just go ahead and jump into it. I introduce everybody as they come up. So here we go again with that Sunday afternoon readings in the second day of Poets at Art Fest 2024. Here we go.
Up next, Jen Frankel is a poet and writer living in Hamilton, Ontario. Her new book, Mayhaps, Poetry of Longing, Loss, and Love, came out in August of 2023. She created the weekly literary open mic Write On, Write Now in Toronto and even hosts it sometimes. Let's bring up Jen.
Hello, everyone. It's been a very challenging year for me in terms of mental health. I lost about 4 months to just bad medication and illness. But because I'm like most of you, I also put out two books of one while I was in hospital. This book came out last year. It's a little poetry chapbook. I've got copies for sale over there for $10 if anybody's interested. Usually when I've been reading from this, I read from the beginning of the book, which is longing, and then I read some love, and then I read loss. But I'm feeling like with the way that the year is going, I'm just going to do it in backwards order. So we're going to start with loss and head back towards the longing. I'm going to slightly censor this poem. I'm not going to drop an F-bomb on you, but you will know that I have replaced it with another word. It's called, Oh God. Dear God, screw you, God. Whenever I ask you for something, you answer. No complaints there. You answer my prayers, but oh God, dear God, screw you, God, to answer me with something that hurts me for the asking. To the plea for understanding, you gave me someone who understood me all too well and used that to torture me with my own words, with my deepest hopes and darkest dreams, who knew me only enough to know what would destroy the little sense I had of my own self. To the wish for love, you sent the entities that feed upon it, created it in me just so that they could eat it up. They broke that part of me that loved and walked away unheeding. When I ask you for a companion, an analog in need, a man who would see me as I am and not turn away, this was hardest yet because you sent him, almost perfect, just as I requested. Intellect to spare and such a heart as well. When do you see wholesome and exciting come together? Never. The intensity of good conversation, coupled with potential for it to be something more, and by more, I mean a life, not a romance, not a fling, not just the body, but achievement. A man who could see at last, see me and not fear, who could see me and collaborate, work, art, life. For me, they are the same. I won't be boxed, compartmentalized. I am my work, my art, my life. And you sent me a man who feels the same. So where is he now? Did I disappoint? Where so many have disappointed me. Was I a single note in his symphony, a melody among others, or worse, just a short counterpoint to what he sang alone? Oh God, dear God, screw you, God, because you know the only way to hurt someone with nothing is to give her exactly what she wants, but not let her keep it. To send her something not broken as before, but someone to point out the brokenness in her. They get lighter. This is called I Will Not. I will not call in anger, in a spirit of castigation, in apology, during a night of loneliness and tears, to rant and rave, to tell him that I love him still, to crow over my brave new self, to say I miss him, to lie, in hatred, in icy fury, in utter defeat. Why then, and when would I ever call? The end of détente. We digress from friendship into silence. The ceasefire whose very existence we ignored, broken by ominous sounds in the distance. I thought you saw me as one of the human race, not an enemy combatant, or perhaps a tame member of my sex, smart enough to see that what you know is true. I was no spy in your camp, but I cannot pretend I knew from the start what this point was where we'd clash. The mistake you made is to imagine that I am a warrior for my sex and not the same as I thought you, one who fights not the circumstances, but the hatred at its heart. Fear is my enemy, not men. If I want to break women from their chains, believe this, that I see the shackles that bind you to history as well, you and the unfortunate of your sex. You ask me, what gives me the right to impose my beliefs? But I say, what I offer is an escape from fear. What the emancipated do beyond the wire is up to them. But to show you a way through slavery to hope, is that not your aim as well? We come at the objective from different paths. Let's attack it together. Emancipate humanity, because I cannot be a party to the demonizing of your sex or mine. You should have had more care, speaking to one of the last friendly envoys as if she were a quisling or a broken pet. That was all from Loss. I'm going to read one from Love and one from Longing, just to finish up. This is called I Love a Man in Glasses. I love a man in glasses. It's always such a revelation, such a surprise, to take those glasses off him and to really see his eyes. Yours are so much bigger than I had thought, blind and blue and huge, as if the lenses of your glasses were somehow bulletproof, to protect you from the hostile world. Without them, you are vulnerable, open then to mocking you may not ever see. So I understand, love, that honor, that sweet pleasure to know that you feel safe with me. And this is called Really, I Come Here Just to Watch Him. Really, I come here just to watch him. Though the atmosphere is tolerable, I suppose. Just the right mix of smoked wood and neon, with the jostling music of late-night fiasco weighing ever so lightly on a mind clouded by no more than caffeine and fatigue. I can sit in solitary bliss, my intrusion slight, as his fair head flickers in and out of view. while the coffee in the cup before me is drained into some place in my spleen that aches for some kinder use. And though I'm busy composing thoughts for the day ahead, scratching a monologue of trivial complaint, and though I keep up the pretense of traditional soirees on the traditional light, in the traditional solitude, really, I come here just to watch him. Thank you.
Let's give Jen another hand. Up next, Honey Novick is a singer, songwriter, voice teacher, poet living in Toronto. She's a member of the League of Canadian Poets, Writers Union of Canada, and Poetry and Voice. Her member of provincial parliament nominated her for Poet Laureate for the province of Ontario. She teaches voice yoga. She believes world peace can be created through culture and education. Her website is www.honeynovick, that's N-O-V-I-C-K.com. Let's bring her up.
Wow. Hi, everybody. This is almost like a master class, you know? It's wonderful seeing friends from all over Ontario, Thornhill, Val-David, Quebec is not Ontario, but nevertheless, Ottawa, Cobalt, and all new friends. It's just truly frightening. Anyway. I guess for me, the purpose of poetry is a tool to make a new friend. And sometimes I'm willing to allow my vulnerability to be shared, and sometimes I'm quite defensive and I get very glib. And so I never quite know which voice to use, and so it's a challenge for me always to be in a situation like this where everybody is so excellent, and here I am in the realm of excellence. And you know what all that means in terms of your own thoughts. So okay. As I said, I use poetry to make friends, and so I'm going to share some of my deep thoughts with you. Kintsugi, it's a Japanese word. Kintsugi, this one is for you. I will gather the bits of my fragmented thoughts and somehow glue them together with gold, like the centuries-old Japanese porcelain art form, kintsugi. Shards held together with flowing gold, making the cup different and better and far more beautiful. Flowing gold hardening, connecting each shard, forming new, touching the broken, loving it, knowing it has its own value. To be in the presence of such divinity is to feel, is to be alive, is to care, is to ask to be cared for, is to be open to once again be broken. Oh, thank you. I come from the realm of classical music where you don't applaud after each, you know, so after three is fine. So from a line from a Nelson Ball poem, this is called A Lone Tree. A lone tree, not being able to hide from the axeman, knows its fate. In dignity it stands, grows, shed leaves in autumn, blossoms in spring, divinely glorious in summer. Even though it is invaluable, offering shade, proffering food, exhaling oxygen, to the axeman it is a commodity, unnecessary. To some others, it is a relative, part of the family, as in all my relations. So So, Thorny Cactus, Magical Realism. Just too thorny, that cactus. Nevertheless, it made its opinions heard. When it's too hot outside, it's too cold inside. When it's too cold outside, it's too hot inside. Such is the plight of the windowsill cactus, never being satisfied. Even when the magical Hoya genie plant granted the cactus one wish, the wish to speak and thus be heard, the cactus just complained. With each complaint, a new thorn grew. It didn't take much. With each thorn, the beauty of the cactus grew. There was no middle way. At least, the cactus couldn't see it. Maybe, just maybe, the trick was endure the hot and cold in their own time. Keep complaining and become more beautiful. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Just stay away from the thorns. I want to share with you, the t-shirt I'm wearing is a print of a painting of my friend Pauline Shirt, who passed away last month. She was the Cree elder at George Brown College in Toronto, where I'm from. We've been friends for over 50 years. We were like sisters. And so I wrote this for Pauline, Bagels and Bannock. Bagels and Bannock and Bannock and Bagels, circles, feeding other circles, nurturing food, feeding the soul, soul dance, solo dance, dance in a circle or dance in a line, lines tied together become circles. And so both Bagels and Bannock are bread. Bagels are European and traditionally thought of as from the Jewish culture. Bannock is the First Nations fry bread and traditionally thought of at feasts and powwows. I first tasted Bannock at a celebration through my friendship with Pauline Shirt. I'm thinking, how much should I reveal? So the very first time I saw you, Bruce, was at a wonderful festival in Oshawa called the Stellar Literary Festival. And I had just written this poem, and John B. Lee edited it. So here it is. When nature is my beehive. Where nature is my beehive, there is freedom to flit, flee, or frolic. I could buzz as a honeybee, fly at 20 miles per hour using all six legs, five eyes, and two sets of wings. I could live in a colony, a sort of commune with workers, a queen, and drones. As a female, I could be queen or worker. Only males are drones, and they do no work at all. Such their job is to fertilize the queen. With 20,000 to 60,000 bees in a colony, drones just drone. It is no wonder that workers sting, but only if feeling threatened. Worker bees die once they sting. Drones have no stinger. Is this not an interesting look at male-female relations? Queens have a stinger, but they don't leave the hive, not even to help defend it. I could be a queen honeybee or a unionized labor bee sucking pollen from flowers, blossoms, or fields. These days, there is a mysterious honeybee holocaust. Bees are dying by the thousands, and no one knows why. Not to scare my honeybee self, maybe I could become another kind of creature spirit. Where nature is my beehive, I fly, saunter, morph, exist on my terms. When nature is my beehive, I am unfettered. And so... Thank you really for listening. Okay, don't encourage me, I have to tell you that much. So I'll just do a few more, since you're not showing any kind of hook. The blackness of amazing. Blackness, while prone, comforts me. blackness while standing personifies the fear that if I am to go further into life, I must enter the blackness. I imagine this non-color as a swaddling cloth wrapping me, wrapping my fear, my ignorance, until an edginess propels me to reach for the light, any light, a light switch, a lighted path, an enlightened idea. Throughout this life's journey, I associate mostly with this amazing black, the beatnik black of fashion, diamond black hair dye, coal black tracing the almond of my eyes, the black macadam I traverse by car or on foot, the blackness of being bad, sinful, the wearing gothic black on lips that were punished in a secondary school that didn't recognize nor appreciate individuality, experimentation, or self-expression. I could always rely on the amazing blackness, as I rely on night turning day, turning night again. Pitch black always stumped me. I could never fathom pitch black, the sound of black. Not racial, but sound devoid of color. And because I cannot see or hear this absence, I celebrate possibility as it unfolds against a backdrop of an amazing black. So, thank Dory. You. Thank you. What?
Dory.
Oh, why?
For clapping.
Oh, please. Okay. So, I want to pose something to everybody, and I'm quite serious about this. I have never read this in public before, so I apologize to you if it bombs. So, this is just strictly my opinion. I keep hearing constantly people talking about change. You may as well, you may also have heard people talking about they want change. And I keep thinking, well, I do too, but I think change has to happen within myself. And sometimes we can have these conversations, and there's some people that I just think, no, it's a waste of time. So anyway, when I get frustrated, I write. Change, change. Everyone wants change. 2 fives for a 10, 4 quarters for a buck, but that's not the change I'm talking about. Change the world, change the mood, change the circle, make it good. C-H-A-N-G-E. Find out what this means to me. Nothing changes until we change first. Change our mind, change our view, change our stance. It's hard to do. I-M-H-O, in my humble opinion, change starts with me. Change my mind, change my view, change my stance. It's hard to do, but not at the price of my integrity. I'll reach out my hand, offer a smile, and be a new friend, all in the name of peace. Thank you. So I would like to sing one song and then read my piece from our wonderful book, if I have the time, do I? Oh, he said yes. Okay. I come to poetry through singing, through music. And one of the earliest serious projects I took on was researching Yiddish culture. And in New York City in the early 1900s, 1920, something like that, there was a group of intellectuals. They were men who were day workers, like they would work painting, how do you say, painting wallpaper, painting walls, putting wallpaper on walls, woodworkers, those kinds of, you know, men who worked with their hands. But they would get together once a week and write poetry and music. And I discovered this lovely poem that somebody set to music. And it's a very simple one. It basically talks about somebody longing for their lover. And they talk about how they are, what's the word, when you toss and turn on a bed of straw while you're just waiting. And just waiting on this bed of straw while the night turns dark and you still have hope that your longing will be fulfilled. It's called Liebstet Meiner, and it means my love. Liebstet Meiner, Liebstet Schwester meine, ich denk noch dir also. Liebster meine, ich denk noch dir also. Es ist mein Bett mit Puchgebet und ich wage es euch streu. Liebster meine, ich denk noch dir also. Liebster meine, ich denk noch dir also. Die Nacht gewahrt, und der Tag kommt schon grün. Liebster meiner, ich denk noch dir also. Liebster meiner, ich denk noch dir also.
Thank you, thank you. I love singing that song. Okay, so finally, it's my privilege in front of Jen Frankel to share this with you. For all of us who have a copy of this book, you can either see the words and picture us. So I'm just going to give you the bit of a preamble. The piece I want to share with you is called J. Edgar. And for those of us who are a certain generation, you remember the horror that was J. Edgar in the early 1950s, yes. Whew. Anyway, so J. Edgar is a film made in 2011, directed, co-produced, and scored by Clint Eastwood. It stars Leo DiCaprio as the first head of the United States Federal Bureau of Investigation, who lasted nearly 50 years. He was the most prominent anti-communist in the USA, albeit during the McCarthy era. After his death, it was revealed that he abused his power using the Bureau to harass, threaten, and amass secret files and collect evidence using illegal means against activists, political dissenters, and political leaders. On March 19, 1954, Edward R. Murrow wrote, "This is no time for men who oppose Senator McCarthy's methods to keep silent, or for those who approve. We can deny our heritage and our history, but we cannot escape responsibility for the result. There is no way for a citizen of a republic to abdicate his responsibilities. As a nation, we have come into our full inheritance at a tender age. We proclaim ourselves, as indeed we are, the defenders of freedom wherever it continues to exist in the world. But we cannot defend freedom abroad by deserting it at home." So that was from Edward R. Murrow. This is from me, part one. J. Edgar, a movie, was on TV at the time of this writing. I couldn't watch it. It reminded me of a time my parents took into our home a family of four: husband, wife, son, and daughter. Not because they were communists, they were, but because they were Jews. The husband was imprisoned for his beliefs. Upon release, they were homeless, but not for long. And thus, my life changed for the better. These wonderful people were humanistic, caring, and never lost a sense of purpose. They didn't demean a child, me, didn't disrespect the differing opinions of my father, who really didn't want them, but bowed to the demands of what things cost. And so, their rent money was necessary.
And now I'm reminded of those days, the days when I would peek out the window and see men sitting in a sedan outside our house day after day. When I asked my mother about this, she said, "Get away from the window and don't touch the curtain." This is in my life. I'm too young to know about Nazi Germany and World War II, but I clearly remember McCarthyism in Canada. I repeat, in Canada. Red baiting. I fear we've gone back in time to the early 1950s, when it was prudent to get away from the window and not move the curtains. I thought we came a long way, baby. I thought the war was worth fighting for, and it was. At least fighting Nazis in World War II was, and always will be. And now we're back there again. A reporter ordered from her job by a nation's president, a federal judge fired for forewarning the same president, he who offered to bring jobs back. Ha! Huh. If you can't muzzle them, get rid of them. If they look too ugly, put them somewhere they can't be seen. If they can't fight and put their lives on the line, they become invisible. These are the times. Cynical, yes. Hopeless, not. Part two. In the 2010s, I was artist in residence for a theater company. To help out, I did box office one Friday. I was looking down at the till. When I looked up, a face stared at me. I was dazed, like a deer in headlights. The face was the same face as the boy in the family that lived with us in the 1950s. I said, "Are your grandparents Bella and Joe?" Yes, she replied. "How did you know?" I said, "You have Arthur's face." I wanted to keep in touch with her, and after several years, we connected. Together, we drove to the Kingston Arts Festival, a spiritual thread. A true connection is never broken. Thank you so much, Bruce, for everything, and thank you, everybody, for listening to me.
Let's give Honey another hand.
I'm right.
Ron Chase is a Kingston area poet whose work can be found in various literary journals and anthologies, and he can often be found late at night, hunched over a tiny black desk, writing truths that hide during the day, or testing new work at open mic nights and literary events. Let's bring up Ron Chase.
I'll just warn you that a couple of these are really new and pretty raw, so I just had to test them out here. Then I'll throw in a couple from Bruce's anthology. Bathroom mirror. The bathroom mirror stared into my eyes through the film of tiny circles, dried droplets suspended in time between what he saw and what I was. The creases in that man's face stenciled a tired cartograph of the roads I never took and the stories he will never tell. His fingers ran over the stubble of human foliage growing like purslane on sun-baked clay. I felt his bristles through my fingertips as his hand slowly moved up and down in disbelief, cupping that tired face in the hand of someone's grandfather. His skin hinted of another life, a long-ago life, not so weathered. His blue eyes were still back there. They could both see it, trapped. I wonder if he remembers the sound of my mother calling supper in that old clapboard farmhouse, or the chords to Sound of Silence. The reason I ache inside in the early morning hours. The name of that woman I work with sometimes, or where I parked my car. He looks lost and sad. I wish I could help him. He looks kind and almost familiar. I may have known him when we were young.
Can you raise your voice a little? It's difficult to hear.
Sure.
That's not a microphone.
Right. The label. He read the label like a bedtime story. Wild turkey, Kentucky straight, bourbon whiskey. Bourbon whiskey du Kentucky. The bottle felt cool against his skin, comforting, like a mother's hand on the forehead of a feverish child. Then he put it back on the shelf where it belonged. But he still didn't sleep. The edge. His dry bones rattled on their own as he walked to the window just to stare at the night and try to catch some rogue thought that raced just out of reach. The wind outside hummed in cruel syncopation with the random leaves and thoughts blowing inside his head. He stood there for hours. Grandma's apple pie cooling on the windowsill, waiting for its time. All he could see was a long, smooth crack separating the blackness from tomorrow. He studied it. That tiny tangerine sliver almost stirred some primordial hope, but it didn't linger. He shuffled back to his bed and sat on the edge, where he had lived his life. Pages from a journal. June 15. I watched a stranger get dressed in my foggy bathroom mirror. He put on my favorite shirt. I think I got it in Nova Scotia, but I'm pretty sure I've never been there. He was old and a little softer around the middle, but his eyes of stone told stories. They were sad yet still smiling, almost laughing at a life that was never able to kill him. Tenacious, more like a mule than a gladiator, but I could tell there had been battles. June 19. I watched a stranger get dressed in my foggy bathroom mirror. I think I've seen him before. He was full of purpose. I didn't want to interrupt the old fellow. I have something to do too. It's important. I'll have to check my notes when I get to work. June 27. I watched a stranger get dressed in my foggy bathroom mirror. He looked angry or frustrated. He hummed some tune that was familiar, but I couldn't quite place it. Why wouldn't he sing the words? I could see the streaks where he wiped the mirror with my blue towel. I hate that. Sing the damn words. I closed the door when he turned to look at me. I saw my father. Every blood vessel surged. My head throbbed. He went back to the earth long ago, so it couldn't have been him. I should go. I'll be late again. A burrito for lunch sounds good. June 29. I didn't bother to shower today. This is the last of my new ones. Morning tea. At the risk of being slapped with an old cliche, she simply took his breath away as she emerged from her cocoon of wrinkled blankets and far too many pillows. No makeup, hair swirling about her head like a perfect storm, freckles laid out like breadcrumbs leaving trails to soft lips and never-ending eyes. A little grumpy that the morning arrived so soon after night did. Soft and warm and melty like a chocolate bar held in your palm too long. Smooth and sweet, soothing to the troubled soul. But first there must be tea. Don't say a word until there is tea. Then I'll pop these two in from the anthology. Longing. My pen longs to write simple secrets for you to place on your tongue and whisper to yourself when you are alone, when you most need to hear what I am not saying, when you most need to place another scrap in your shoebox at the back of your closet where no one ever sees. And I'll finish off with this one. Your grave. Your grave stands neglected. The raised letters on the soft stone that once spoke your name have all but been erased by the hard breath of time and the tears of those who used to visit and lay lilies in the warm spring sun. No one comes to cry anymore. No one brings flowers on your birthday. The grass has grown tall. The sandy soil that blankets you has sunken like an old man's eyes. Now your marker only shows where someone long ago placed an empty shell they once loved. Thanks.
Let's give Ron another hand. Up next. Calista Markotich, poems by Calista Markotich, former superintendent of education, appear in numerous Canadian reviews and quarterlies from ARC through Vellum and in several American and British magazines and journals. Her poetry has received first and second place awards and placement in the League of Canadian Poets Poem in Your Pocket campaign. It has been shortlisted and honorably mentioned in Canadian contests and nominated for a Pushcart Prize and the National Magazine Awards. Her Sweet Edward was a finalist in the 2023 Gwendolyn McEwen Poetry Award and the 2024 Toad Hall Chapbook Contest with the Poets Corner. She is contributing editor for ARC Poetry. Calista's first collection, Wrap in a Big White Towel, 2024, was just published by Frontenac House. She lives gratefully on the banks of the Lake Ontario, on Lake Ontario, traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and the Haudenosaunee Nation, here in Kingston, Ontario, with her husband, Don, of 59 years. Let's bring Calista.
Hi. Thanks very much for being here. Here's my new book. It's quite new. My granddaughter actually painted the cover for this book. So I'm especially proud of the cover, but actually I'll address myself a bit to what's inside. Can you hear okay? All right. I'll try to use my teacher voice. All right. I don't think the kids really enjoyed my teacher voice much. The first poem, I have been at a couple of readings since this book was launched, and mostly I end up reading the ones in here that have to do with family, and they're more emotional, and I've read them. So I went a different way this time, and I hope you like these poems. They're all about men, not men I know, men I have read about or heard about. And the first one is... it's called PTSD in the Epoch of Prophets. And the genesis of that is that we have probably, as human beings, always had post-traumatic stress disorders, but only recently have they been named as such. So there must have been peculiar behaviors on the part of people before it was named. And this happens to be Jonah. PTSD in the Epoch of Prophets. In Nineveh, shadow faces loomed and leered while Jonah, whale-punked and glazed with stink, flailed around the marketplace gabbling gibberish doom. a shadow crowd pulled close by horror, cast taboos against his devils. Shadow mothers dragged their small ones from his lurid lurch and totter. His self-stuffed senses shunned the scent of Assyrian women, littering him from the rustlings of a mob, stripping him of rags stiff from rime of bile and blood, soaking scabs of slime and seaweed, bombing slashes from the sailor's gaffs, burns from the masticating gut of the whale, abrasions from the convulsive belch that hurled him half dead onto pebbly shores near the town of Nineveh. Panicked in the brine, reliving the swallow, retch, and drown, the frothy flow pulling him into blackness when he was Jonah still. Above the marketplace, tattered fringes of the canopies were, in his wild eyes, a gray baleen with undulating bristle. He felt its brushy wave against his face in watery rush. The alleyways were to him dark, open maws. Unnamed the horror that compelled his stumble back to pebbly shores near Nineveh, scant protected by his coil of rag, rust-red as seaweed soaked in oxides of the deep. In stark night, he draws himself afloat, lies limp, water as his bier or bed, hair of flotsam hemp like sailor's knots unraveled by the sea, waiting for fate, waiting for a blacker black to rise, waiting for a whale to breach. And the second one is to the, it's addressed to the Brothers Grimm. The Brothers Grimm told fairy tales, many of which were actually very grim. And this one was written after I had read this poem to this story to a granddaughter, but I read somewhere that there was so many dwarves, so many people who were dwarves in those fairy tales, that there was some thought that when they were dwarves, they might be children who, through child labor, such as mining, you know, the seven dwarves were miners, were children, and they were small, but they were presented in the folklore as dwarves. It's a theory. It's not necessarily true. I would rather imagine it isn't true. Brothers Grimm. Brothers, say justice was done, and the queen a tinkle of mirror in a torrent of shards, and the apple peddler hissed to her doom in a punishing whirl. Say Snow White is asleep, and the page has turned on root-ripped fissures in the path, and her branch-clawed waistcoat skirt and flying hair intact, and my granddaughter's cheek a cool tulip petal against my arm. Brothers, it's dwarves she asks about. And I breathe the bedtime clean child fragrance in her hair. And Jacob, Wilhelm, say they were not children working mines, stunted, red-eyed, noses black with soot, you dressed as little adults for your lore. I'll believe you, Brothers Grimm, for how to explain to this child, children in pitchy earth, longing for sky above black firs and sunlight sifting through forest glades. And by my side, a sweet, slight weight leans into the soul of me, and warmth, sleep seeps through my ribs. And twilight peaks our bedside rug, the ancient art of warp and weft. Let's not say the childish fingers ply the jeweled strands in age-old tribal ways. And on the footboard hangs a size 4 pale blue bunny robe from some place where small hands learn calluses in warehouse gloom. Don't say that padlocks close that door. Grimm's, she's 5 and close to sleep. Say once upon a time. Say happily ever after. Thank you. And this poem is about Ernest Shackleton's boat, the Endurance, and which was found in just a couple of years ago, amazingly, after 100 years, more than 100 years. And so the amazement was that it was found, and the other amazement is that it was in such perfect condition because the water was so cold that everything was preserved. The report in the Smithsonian Magazine said, a team of researchers has discovered the wreck of Ernest Shackleton's Endurance vessel on the Antarctic seafloor. And it was March 11th, 2022. Ice rasp and water sluice. A voice. There she goes. Her crushed bow. Her shattered masts, her stern with its gaping wound, her rigging tangle trailing her descent like a flag of truce with the Weddell Sea, the ice released her from the heave of floes, and the Antarctic took her down. Shackleton, his carpenter and cook, his men of science and men of the sea, watched her go with grief-tight throats and stricken eyes of blue, gray, brown, now closed for decades on this earth. But eyes are on her now. Drone eyes like fish on fire, darting in delight, beacons sweeping the deep, clear black. The ship's wheel waiting for the skipper's hand. A strewn galley, crockery, a boot, anchor chains laid snake-like in the silt, forensic of the sundered rudder, torn astern, retelling the bitter tale. And the ship, preserved by grace of water, frigid, turgid with cold and salt, and through this water lens, pristine as space, her name in letters curved above the stern. And believe it, Ernest Shackleton was lowered in his Griffin grave 1 century ago this very day, and in a wheel room 500 fathoms up above, throats tight with awe are whispering, there she is. Okay, and the next man is Icarus. We've all heard of Icarus, but this poem, I'm reading it because a friend that I trust says it's his favorite poem here, but I think that just because he likes the Corleones and is a devotee of the Godfather. So you're kind of asked to imagine that while it's a painting, Icarus is a sentient being at the same time. It's asking a lot of the listener. A painted Icarus watches the Godfather from across the room. My body a sunlit feathery arch on cerulean blue. Dad, a frantic figure far below. Artist captured in panic brushstrokes, his face an upturned oval. We are painted, oil on canvas, gallery framed, and hung above the Tweedy sofa. My tiny father from a bluff below, over a sea of Windsor blue, is shouting, Icarus! Above the fireplace opposite us, a flat screen flickers its complicated ego. Shriek of night traffic, rattle of trattoria, gun, baseball bat. An aria rising like benediction. The first communion of a child. Black tie, white cummerbund, succour of flesh and blood. The pound of a strip club, other flesh, shiver of icy martini. No one rises in order to descend. Splendorous under the sun, my soaring heart thumps. Waxy grommets bloom along my outflung arms. The feathers turn. The hollow shafts lose purchase. Plume after tallow tip plume luff and hurl away. A moment of loft, a flutter into gravity's long pull. My naked arms a wreckage. Above the glitter of table and lamps, above the fireplace, with the omnivision of a painted saint, I see the dawn must fall. Dawn being that Dawn. Okay. And the last one, I think timed at home. It shouldn't be more than 12 unless I talk too much. But this one is just, this is not biblically correct. It presupposes that Noah was actually told to release the animals from the stewardship of human beings. Because human beings are very whimsical with animals. Some they love, some they fear, some they protect, some they don't. That was the idea for this. It's not what it says in the Bible. What Noah knows. Look at him. He doesn't resemble the Genesis Noah. That beard depicted as a dagger of righteousness stabbing low billowing cloud, eyebrows hirsute, plastered to a jutting forehead, storm-sculpted locks streaming onto the great deck, that body its own ark, submissive yet proud before the Lord. This Noah is draped over the gunwale, shoulder blades a bony yew, head hanging like a worn mule, emaciated buzzard. He squints down at 1,000 wooden pegs drawn one by one, the great ramps lowered from the ark's mighty side to the wet rock of Mount Ararat on which the craft reclines. No muscular god felled a timber, hoisted a beam, yet from somewhere came a god-sized will, fanatical strength, urging Noah to a purpose that belied common sense, embarrassing him as night after night he fell limp onto his pallet beside his skeptical wife, who can't believe that he, Noah, embodies God and will proclaim God's new wishes for the animals. Yet now is that moment, and he cannot. His oration ferments in his mouth like juice of the barreled fruit he's been swilling for days. The animals are passing into the fullness of time. Mankind will steward them forever. No one knows of the eggs Nama collects in her shawl. He knows of the small furry whelp from the on-voyage litter Arathka has hidden in her baskets, uncaring of the nursing bitch searching through the throng with frantic eyes. He himself has shown impudence. He has bestowed on his elephant a name lacking all dignity. Even in his wine-flown state, Noah knows it will be a strange and complicated husbandry.
Let's give Calissa another hand.
And you just heard from Poets at Art Fest 10, our readings by Jen Frankel, Honey Novick, Ron Chase, and Calista Markotich. It is 58 minutes after 4 o'clock. I tell you what, let's do this, and I'll be right back.
Two out of three geese. Six out of seven seagulls. And this Transylvanian owl. All agree that if they had their own radios, they would tune in to CFRC 101.9 FM. Broadcasting just for you from Kingston, Ontario, Canada.
Keep up with what's hot on CFRC Airwaves. Find us today on Instagram and Facebook. Follow us at CFRC Music and keep your finger on the pulse of Kingston's best music mix.
And we are quickly approaching 5 o'clock, so let's just go ahead and lead into it early. Before I do that, though, I want to thank Jen, Honey, Ron, and Calista for their wonderful readings at the event this past year, the crowd who came to support them, and a heartfelt thanks to all of you for tuning in to the first hour this afternoon. You are and have been listening to Finding a Voice here on CFRC 101.9 FM. We do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. Just want to mention, just the reminder that every week, both hours of this show are uploaded to my blog space for it at Finding a Voice on cfrcfm.wordpress.com. Remain there for 3 years, and usually get that done about 7 o'clock when I get home. We're a few seconds early, but I'm going to go ahead and just go into the second hour. It is essentially 5 o'clock, and you are listening to Finding a Voice here on CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce. I'm here every